Hi, I'm Chas Vegland. Municipal bonds. Okay, before you fall asleep, they're usually a reliable investment. But with state budgets in a crunch, are they still? Yes, barring a total collapse of the system.
In which case, you have other things to worry about. You know, like, why is there no state government anymore?
Yeah, that would be worrisome. Last year, we profiled the ladies of the formerly Baroque Investment Club. How are they doing in 08?
I started comparing it to having a really good friend, and all of a sudden, you no longer have as much fun together.
Well, here's some fun. Extra points if you can cite the relevance of this numerical string.
1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, 12, 13, 15.
The Fibonacci sequence? The ages of my cats? No, I don't have that many. We'll explain, coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. We've been concentrating a lot over the last several months on the fast-moving developments in the financial crisis. The cold stew of wild stock market swings, banks vanishing into the ether, government bailouts of entire industries. Anyone hungry for a little personal finance bread and butter? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
Today we start with something that happens year in and year out. It isn't really related to the meltdown, but is still vitally important to a huge swath of the population. Seniors have until December 31st to make decisions about Medicare Part D, which plans they want to use. So here with an explainer is Jack Hoadley of Georgetown's Health Policy Institute. And Jack, I assume if your prescriptions have changed, that would be one reason to review your plan?
Absolutely. People's needs do change. And while sometimes people's prescriptions people use may stay the same for a period of time, certainly if they're in the same plan they first enrolled in 3 years ago, they may have new prescriptions since then. And what we know is that the prescriptions you use tend to be very influential in determining which plan is the best plan for you. It's not just what the monthly premium is, but it's the cost of those individual prescriptions that you take.
So how do you go about figuring out what plan is best for you? I mean, in some states, seniors are facing, 30, 40, 50 different plans. Is this just a matter of doing the math?
It really is, in the end, a matter of doing the math. And the question is, how hard it is to do that math. Medicare.gov has a very good plan finder tool. Of course, not everybody is savvy with using the internet, and even using that program as good as it is. And so for many people, it may be getting the help of a family member, getting the help of a counselor of some sort to help them think through those alternatives.
Are there any changes to Medicare Part D itself in 2009?
There really is not, for the most part. I mean, the benefit does make certain changes each year. So in 2009, the standard benefit has a deductible of $295. In other words, the first $295 of your cost you would pay out of pocket. And then you get coverage up until you've incurred a total of $2,700 in drug costs. That's both your costs and the part that the plan pays. And on average, you're paying about 25% of the cost of the drugs in that what we call the initial coverage period. After that first $2,700 in total drug costs, that's when you enter the coverage gap or the donut hole. And that lasts for about $3,450. So you're paying out of pocket for the next almost $3,500 of drugs that you incur.
When Part D debuted, 3 years ago now, there was all kinds of confusion. Is it any better now?
Well, one thing that's better, of course, is that most people are in plans now. 3 years ago, we were needing to get people just to be aware that the benefit existed. Now it's a matter of if you don't do anything, you're still in the plan that you were in last year. So at least the default is that you continue to be covered. The downside of that is you may be covered in a plan that's not the best deal for you.
So the deadline is coming up December 31st. What happens if folks don't enroll on time?
If they are in a plan today and they don't do anything, they just stay in the plan they're in, and they will, of course, face some changes in their premiums, perhaps changes in their copays. if there's somebody who is not in a plan at all and they now think they need to be in one, obviously that's a situation that says they need to get enrolled in a plan. This is their opportunity. And if they miss this opportunity, they may have to wait until next year.
And aren't there some financial penalties if you are late?
There are. If somebody who was first eligible 3 years ago and is still never enrolled, they're paying a penalty that's equivalent to 1% of the average premium for every month that they did not enroll, and that's now 3 years. So that's a lot of money, and if they don't sign up this year, that penalty will continue to accumulate for every month and every year they don't sign up.
Jack Hoadley is an analyst with the Health Policy Institute at Georgetown University. Thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This year forced many of us to question, where exactly is a safe place to park our cash? Yes, if your bank is FDIC insured, you're safe, but it's still disconcerting to watch the likes of IndyMac go under. Yes, the government is now guaranteeing money market mutual funds, but for a few days in September, you had to wonder. And now there's a bit of drama surrounding municipal bonds. Investors are refusing to buy them, so prices are tumbling. John Wagoner is a mutual fund expert with USA Today. John, what is behind the sell-off?
The reason they've had problems is because of the credit crunch. People who are lending money only want to lend money to people who will absolutely, no kidding, really, guaranteed give it back to them. And that's why this week we saw the investors were willing to accept a zero yield for investing to the United States Treasury, because all they want is their money back. They don't care about no stinking interest.
So they have been fleeing from muni bonds just like every other investment?
Absolutely right. And it's had a lot of bad effects, one of which is that it's much harder for states and towns and counties to raise money for things they might need, like schools and roads and water systems.
Well, how rational is this flight? Are muni bonds still a good investment, even though people are dropping them left and right?
Oh, yeah, they're excellent investments. In fact, they have a much better track record for repaying investors than corporate bonds. And it's extraordinarily rare for a municipal bond to default. It's big news when it happens. And, you know, look, we've been through a period when all kinds of terrible things have happened that we didn't expect. But by and large, I would say that muni bonds are an exceptionally safe bet.
Let's talk about the difference in risk between a muni bond mutual fund versus buying them individually.
Here's the difference. If you buy a muni bond, you're agreeing to lend to, say, the state of California $1,000 at a set rate of interest. So every 6 months, you'll get an interest payment from California, provided they don't default. And after the end of 10 years, you'll get your money back. A muni fund is basically where people pool their money together to buy a whole bunch of different municipal bonds, sometimes from different states, sometimes of different maturities, of different credit qualities. And the idea being is that, okay, supposing California defaults on one issue of its bond, hey, you've got 50 other bonds, and so it's going to be only 1/50th of your portfolio, and you don't really stand any big chance of loss.
Unless everybody goes running for the exits.
Yeah, in which case you have other things to worry about, you know, like, why is there no state government anymore?
I'll give you that it's probably unlikely that states are going to start defaulting all over the country. But, I mean, in this era right now, is anything really impossible?
Well, no, and that's a good point. And that's one reason why you might not want to invest in individual bonds, because the temptation always is to buy the bonds with the highest yield. Well, unfortunately, the ones with the highest yields are trying to entice you to buy them because they have really rotten credit ratings. You know, it's like lending to two people, either, you know, your wonderful brother Sam, who's, you know, a PhD and, you know, has a zillion dollars, and your no good nephew Fred. You might get a higher rate of return from, you know, from your no good nephew. But how long is that going to go on, you know, before he splits for Vegas? So what people often fall into when they try to buy individual bonds and say, I'm going to get this nice, fat, juicy yield, when in fact, they'd be better with a like what's called a general obligation bond, which is what is issued by the state itself. It's backed by the taxing authority of that state. The odds of that defaulting are very low indeed.
John Wagoner is the chief mutual fund reporter at USA Today and also the author of Bailout, What the Collapse of Bear Stearns Means for Your Personal Finances. Thanks so much for your time today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. With me, as always, is our own Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So at the top of our conversation with John Wagoner, he alluded to the fact that people have flooded money into treasuries this week for a 0% yield. What is going on here?
It's a flight to safety. People are willing to accept zero. Or perhaps if you're in a money market mutual fund that invests in treasuries, you're getting less than zero. And the reason why you're doing it is you're nervous that those corporate bonds are going to blow up, that the stock market is going to go lower. And so in a sense, you're willing to accept a 0% interest rate or less for the safety, the freedom from the fear of default.
So this is quite literally the equivalent of stashing your cash under the mattress.
Absolutely. Except for it's a lot safer. If you stash your cash under the mattress, you could have a fire. The thing could burn down. Your money could disappear. If you put it in treasury bills, hey, at least you get 99 cents on the dollar back. And you're starting to hear this term, Tess. Do we have a bubble in the treasury market?
Oh, no, not another bubble, please.
So much money is fleeing for safety. It's just remarkable.
Man, you know, and I believe that on Tuesday or Wednesday, the three-month T-bill actually went negative. Explain to me how you can have a treasury that pays negative interest.
Okay, so when you buy your treasury bills, they're at a discount to the face value.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say the face value is $100 and you're willing to pay so that when it 3 months later, you got $99.99 in return.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're just willing to do. This is just very, very stunning. It's starting to grab people's attention. And what I say at this point, you know what? Safety is a good thing. But at this point, for most people, hey, what's wrong with certificates of deposit?
Yeah, a savings account.
Some of these online savings accounts with FDIC-insured institutions, it's not a bad yield. I mean, it's not great, but it's
better than negative.
Let me put it this way. It's better than negative or zero and up to $250,000, which covers most of us.
Does this worry you at all this money going into treasuries?
It worries me a lot because what are people really afraid of? They're afraid of a depression and they're afraid of deflation. And that's what the Fed, the Treasury is fighting against that fear. And the fact of the matter is it's a reflexive instinct to go for safety. Don't take any risk. And by the way, capitalism, it relies on risk taking.
On that note, thank you so much, Chris. And we'll talk to you later in the show with some getting personal questions.
All right. We'll deal with those issues.
How do you break it to friends that you can't afford the kind of gifts you usually give? Simple. They're probably in the same boat.
Many of the people in my immediate circle have been affected by layoffs or company closures. So we have all sort of agreed that we're going to do a lot less this year.
Embracing the role of the new simplifiers this holiday season. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Throughout 2007, I visited with three investment clubs. One of them, a Virginia-based club called Formerly Baroque, had a banner year, as we heard in the final installment of the series last December.
Of the stocks that we currently hold, we had a 16.55% rate of return. I mean, that's what we were.
So we decided to check in with them 1 year later to see how they've weathered one of the worst years ever on Wall Street. They join us from club member June Chaloux's kitchen table in Falls Church, Virginia. So nice talking to you again, June.
Oh, it's very nice talking to you. It's been a while.
And Pat Meadows, you're there as well?
I am also, yes, thank you.
Terrific. And Bobby Manley is joining us.
Bobby Manley sitting right here.
Okay. Well, it's been just over a year since I last visited with you folks. And at the time, I don't know if you want me to remind you of this, but you had $137,879 in your brokerage account. Pat, let me start with you. Can you tell me how you're doing a year later?
Well, I can confirm that we do not have that much money in our account right now. For several reasons, though, we've lost two of our members. So that took, you know, a nice chunk out of the portfolio. And then with the market, we've had some stocks that have not done so well. I heard today that the NASDAQ in the last 4 months was down 40%, and we're not quite that far down yet, 40%. We're just under that. You know, we're close to 60,000, so we're less than
close half. Close to 60,000.
But a good chunk of it came out because we bought out two partners.
June, let me ask you, what are some of the stocks that the club decided to shed this year as it watched the market tank?
Well, we decided early on that we would sell Crocs, and we decided that we would sell Apple, and we sold them both at a high. We then had to sell some of our oil stocks, technology stocks, and the defense stocks, and now we went back into a defense stock, so we've been all over the place, really.
Is that your investment strategy?
No, we have actually, we would go in, we would study the stock, then buy it and watch it go down just like every other stock did in the market.
Yeah.
And after a while, we decided that we really were studying and had good companies and we were going to just hold on to our stock.
Bobby, June has touched on the volatility of the market over these last several months. Can you describe how the club has dealt with days where the Dow drops 700 points and then a week later it's up 900 points? Are there a lot of conversations that go on in between meetings, or are you at this point kind of thinking maybe that's the new normal?
In the beginning, it was really scary, and we'd talk to one another by email and say, can you believe what happened today? And I think we kind of got numb to it because we had made the decision to hold as best we could. Whether we feel like it's the new norm, I don't think so. I hope it's not, because it just gives you ulcers, if nothing else.
Pat, when did you all decide, and how did you decide, to basically stick this out?
Well, I tell you, we believe the analyst. And everyone kept saying, you know, we think we're near the bottom. We think we're near the bottom. And it wasn't until just recently when people started to say they thought it was going to get worse and worse and worse. And we feel now that we're trapped, that we had held on, and we, you know, it's a paper loss. And as long as we still have the stocks, we haven't recognized the loss. But we are still enjoying, you know, having the club. We've been together too long to take it too seriously. When we invested, we all said we were going to invest with the idea that it was, you know, money that we could lose if we had to. We don't want to, but we're just kind of hanging in there.
June, I wonder if I could ask you what might be a bit of a sensitive question, but knowing what good friends you all are in the club, did you notice any sort of change in the dynamic within the group in a year that was so terrible versus the past several years when, boy, it must have been a pleasure to always go because you were making a lot of money?
Yes, I think we all noticed that the dynamics did change from going to the meetings and having a lot of fun and just laughing about, well, do we buy this stock or that stock? We had to really stop and analyze whether or not we should even buy stocks at all. And finally, we came to the conclusion we did need to stop and just watch the stocks that we had. And some of the members felt that the club was no longer as much fun.
Bobby, within the club, has there ever been any sentiment from members who say, you know what, I'm done. No more stocks.
No. I don't think anybody completely thinks that the stock market's no good. I feel like our stock market will turn around. It might take it a long time. But I feel strongly that the stock market is still a good way to invest your money.
Pat?
I agree with Bobby that it's... It's an American institution. I mean, it's a way of life. I know that sometimes that sounds like we're pie in the sky and we're Pollyannas, But the alternative is to be negative thinker, and we choose not to do that.
Well, June Shalhoub, Pat Meadows, and Bobby Manley, all members of the formerly Baroque Investment Club in Virginia, thanks for sharing, and maybe we'll check in with you again in a year.
Thanks, Tess.
Thank you very much, Tess. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
We learned this week that retail sales fell for a fifth straight month in November. We're just not buying as much stuff, which, frankly, is good. It means we're being more responsible with our money. But then we're also told we're hurting the economy when we don't spend, especially during the holidays. You can't win. Or maybe you can. Sharon McNary tells us about some gift-giving ideas that are good for the wallet and the planet.
You could look at your shrinking holiday budget as one more depressing reminder that the economy isn't what it used to be. Or you can revamp your spending to be more frugal and less wasteful, like Linda Decker, a corporate trainer from the Los Angeles area. She's reducing what she calls her gift footprint. That means she's trying to choose gifts that won't end up as unwanted household clutter. She's avoiding the malls and the big box chain stores and looking for less obvious places to shop. On this Sunday morning, she's looking for gifts at the Montrose Farmers Market north of Los Angeles.
Well, I love to shop the farmers markets in my area, and I love to give my business to those smaller one-of-a-kind companies that may not make it through the current economic climate without the resources that some of the larger companies do.
Linda Decker says one way to reduce your gift footprint is to give things that don't last.
The people in my gift-giving circle seem to end up with a lot of stuff at the end of the holiday. And so I'm trying to come up with gift ideas that are have a short lifespan, a consumable.
For example, food.
I'll be making Meyer lemon curd and marmalade for my family back in Minnesota.
So today she's buying some Meyer lemons.
I want ones with nice yellow skins for the marmalade.
Thank you.
A seemingly opposite strategy is to give old things that last a really long time, like vintage teacups for a friend or a fossil for a nephew. She also buys handmade items from local artists. As someone who recently recovered her financial footing after a layoff, she likes to know who her money is supporting.
In looking at my year, I realized I had to make budget changes. Many of the people in my immediate circle have been affected by layoffs or company closures. So we have all sort of agreed that we're going to do a lot less this year.
Some of her favorite vendors are going through hard times, too. Jewelry maker Michelle Toussignant has a booth at the market.
Let's see, about 6 months ago, we would make anywhere from $500 to $800 just on one Sunday. And now we're lucky if we even make $100 or even our booth space. We're pretty much just paying to be out here.
Linda Decker glances at a couple of Toussignant's pieces, but she doesn't buy anything. Thrifty shoppers like her are known as new simplifiers. That term was coined by Harvard Business School professor John Quelch.
The key thing here is that the simplifier is being motivated by a desire to manage their life in a less complicated way. So it's more the reduction of complexity rather than the simple act of saving money.
As we reach the last booth of the market, a man gives a boy a few dollars to put in the jazz band's tip basket. Linda Decker is having second thoughts about one of those items she saw at Toussignant's jewelry booth, and she heads back for another look. Maybe this time she'll buy something. I'm Sharon McNary for Marketplace Money.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we take our cue from your phone calls and emails. And here to help out with that, as always, is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Des.
So our first question comes from Jessica. She's in Mattawan, Michigan. And Of course, as we all know, the auto industry's troubles are affecting a lot of folks in that state, both directly and indirectly. So, Jessica, I understand your family is facing some pretty tough financial decisions. What's going on?
Just over about a year ago, my husband lost his job, and we were forced to move across the state, which we were very fortunate to find another job in Michigan. But we are still trying to sell our old home, and the home prices are just plummeting. We have the house priced at less than what we owe on it. But in recent talks with our realtor, she's basically told us that we don't have even a remote shot of selling it anywhere near the price we have it at right now. We're really just trying to figure out what to do.
Are you carrying two mortgages at this point then?
Yes, and we have been for over a year now. So now we're wondering, is foreclosure our best option? Do we just sit this out and just keep trying to pay two mortgages for as long as we possibly can? And the thing that's really upsetting is we've really worked hard to preserve our credit. We've paid off all of our debts. We weren't struggling in any other way. And now we're looking at just kind of demolishing that. And the situation is really out of our control.
Is there any chance that you could pay them off for several months to come?
We could stick it out a while longer, but it's at that point where we're dipping into our savings more, and we don't want to keep putting, you know, $20,000 a year toward mortgage payments on this house when we don't know how long that's going to last.
Yeah, and when nobody's living in it. Chris, boy, is foreclosure kind of the better of all evils?
I'm leaning that way, and this is really a sign of the new world that we're in. One of the trigger points for people to really sort of say, you know, we got to really make some hard decisions here, is whether or not you're tapping into your retirement funds, you're not funding your retirement. You talked about that you're tapping into your savings. And what you don't want to end up is in a situation where not only do you have this home that you can't get rid of, but that your overall financial situation just becomes vulnerable to this economy, because we don't know how deep the recession is going to be. We don't know how long the recession is going to be. Here's what I'd be asking myself. Okay, what's the exit strategy? You've talked to attorneys, and I applaud you for that. Because anyone who's thinking about a foreclosure or a short sale, talk to an attorney, a legitimate attorney. There's lots of scams out there. And the foreclosure laws vary greatly by state. Then I would sit down with the attorney, and what you're going to do is cauterize your losses, just like any business does. People need to think more of themselves as a business, a family firm, a family company, and come out with the best solution that protects you.
That's really helpful. And, you know, just really reaffirms the line of thought we've been working toward over this last year. You know, initially looking at this, we thought, oh, no, there's no way we'd be in a foreclosure situation. But now that enough time has passed and the market just keeps declining, we keep thinking, well, that's a real possible option for us.
Well, this is probably very small comfort, but you are far from alone. Hope that helps. And will you let us know what happens?
Yes. Well, and thank you so much for the advice. It's always good to have one more point of view on this. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to an email now from Jeff. He's in St. Paul, Minnesota. In addition to a 403B, which, as we've talked about before, is the nonprofit version of a 401K, Jeff and his wife each have index funds in Roth IRAs, and they'd like to increase their diversification, which we must applaud them for, by switching to a fund that, he says, adjusts based on the age of the investor. So his question is, would this be a bad time to make that change in terms of locking in their losses within the fund that they're already in?
All right. So you are talking about a target date fund. And just a very quick definition, with a target date fund, it's going to be much more heavily into equities and other riskier assets when you're younger. And then as you get closer toward your retirement date, it's gone more conservative, more into bonds, more into bills, more into short-term securities. If it were me, what I would do is open up the account and put my new money into it. So I don't think I would turn this into an either-or question, do I lock in losses or not do this? How about open up the account, put your new contributions into the target date fund?
All right. Well, if you have a question on any and all things related to your finances, do give us a call. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. We spell that M-O-N-Y. Or write to us. You can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And with some of your questions answered, it's now time for your letters and comments about the show. A few weeks ago, we aired a report about families that are making financial decisions about childcare. keep working so you can pay for help, or stay home. It's a long-standing dilemma that still pushes buttons. Comments flooded our website, some of them quite off-putting to listeners like Christina Wolf of Peterborough, New Hampshire.
I'm surprised and dismayed at the vitriol launched at working parents. The stay-at-home mom concept arose only in the Victorian era. Even then, many of those women hired others to raise their children. Don't believe me? Just watch Mary Poppins.
Yes, and Ms. Poppins would also tell you that even in the hurly-burly of the Internet, a spoonful of sugar helps your point go down. A few weeks ago in our Getting Personal segment, a listener wanted to know if there was any way to predict the 2009 IRS mileage reimbursement rate. We did a little math and said, based on what happened when gas prices rose this year, the rate might go down about 4% from 58 cents a mile. We said that would be an 8-cent drop. Remedial math, and you reminded us that 4% of 58 is about 2 cents, not 8. Moot prediction anyway, because the IRS says the new rate is 55 cents a mile. Last month, we aired a story about homeowners taking in roommates in order to avoid foreclosure. Well, that brought back some memories for Nancy Huebner of San Diego, California.
I had to smile at this story. I bought a house with my fiancé 10 years ago. The fiancé thing didn't work, but I wanted to keep the house. Roommates to the rescue.
Last week, we focused on rescuing yourself from all those changes to your credit card. The industry is hiking interest rates and cutting credit limits. Many of you voiced frustration that closing cards, which you would think would make you a more responsible borrower, can actually hurt your credit score. Jack Black of White Plains, New York, used our website to comment that, quote, credit card companies are nothing but legalized loan sharks. Don Keller of Fort Collins, Colorado, heard me joke that maybe all of us should just tear up our cards. Then I sheepishly admitted that would be quite difficult, at least for me. Mr. Keller admonishes that, to the contrary, it was the most sensible and appropriate advice in the entire segment. And finally, Michael Rulison of Raleigh, North Carolina, heard our interview about the record low numbers of office holiday parties this year. Our own marketplace get-together is a festive potluck at our managing editor's home this very weekend. Mr. Rulison offered another suggestion for a low-cost group activity.
The give back would be some form of community service. For example, Habitat for Humanity, Soup Kitchen, Meals on Wheels, anything like that.
Great suggestions. We welcome them and your compliments and complaints. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. With layoffs rising and investments tanking, many people find themselves pondering financial options they never imagined, including the B word.
Bankruptcy is not the mark of Cain. It's not the scarlet letter. Nobody puts a B on your forehead and says, ooh, there goes the bankrupt person.
Chapters 7, 11, and 13 on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. It's easy to get lost in financial statistics, but here's one that stands out even in this economic era. Last month, an average of 5,000 people a day filed for bankruptcy. They asked for either Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 protection. Meanwhile, just this week, the Tribune Company, KB Toys, Easy Lube, and the Baltimore Opera, among others, filed for Chapter 11. Someday we'll be able to turn the page on all of this, close the book on the crisis of 08, but until then, it might be helpful to know just what we're talking about when we cite the B word. Here's Marketplace's Sean Cole with chapter and verse.
To sort through all of this chapter business, I paid a visit to Richard Gottlieb. He's a bankruptcy lawyer in Boston, and he showed me a big, thick, red book.
This is the bankruptcy code and rules.
Good God.
That's the 07 edition. This is the compact version.
Oh, wow.
Open it up, and there's a bunch of weirdly numbered chapters.
1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, 12, 13, 15.
The first few chapters define and lay out the provisions of bankruptcy. 7, 11, and 13 are the most common forms of bankruptcy. And if you study them closely, they tell a story. Once upon a time, in a town called, a horrible recession, there was a three-story building, also known as
Mrs. Jones's house, where Mrs. Jones lives on the second floor. She has a tenant living on the third floor.
Saul
lives on the third floor.
And he was no stranger to misfortune. Laid off, his unemployment had run out.
He says, I owe $2,000 to my landlady for 2 months' worth of rent. I'm being sued also by the Bank of No Equity Visa for their $15,000.
Plus, he owed the IRS a few thousand bucks for... Let's just skip ahead to Chapter 7.
In a Chapter 7 bankruptcy case, what drives the distribution of money to creditors is the liquidation, turning into cash, those assets of the debtor that have a substantial value.
So Saul files Chapter 7, even though he has no substantial assets. Most Chapter 7 filers don't. He has some money left in his IRA, but the government lets him keep that so he can make a meaningful fresh start. So, but for the lawyer fees, Saul pays nothing, his debtors get nothing, and over the next year, his credit score is actually likely to rise. After all, he's debt-free now. Now, this may sound like an overly rosy portrait of bankruptcy, but Gottlieb says too many people think of bankruptcy as a disaster.
Bankruptcy is not the mark of Cain. It's not the scarlet letter. Nobody puts a B on your forehead and says, ooh, there goes the bankrupt person. No, bankruptcy is nothing more and nothing less than a form of financial redemption for both individuals and for businesses.
Which brings us to Chapter 11.
Chapter 11 is a business reorganization.
And on the first floor of Mrs. Jones's building, there was a business called...
Teddy's Internet Cafe.
And Haberdashery.
And Haberdashery, Incorporated.
No stranger to misfortune was Teddy, in part because his business was ridiculous.
Many people, they would come there just to try on the clothes, but not use the computers.
He was delinquent on his business loan, owed his vendors money, and, like Saul, he hadn't paid the rent in months. Chapter 11 is like a timeout. It means his creditors can't take action against him while he reorganizes.
So does he have to stop business while he's in Chapter 11?
No, just the opposite. He continues the exact same way he did. Well, hopefully not the exact same way he did beforehand.
Meanwhile, he has to come up with a repayment plan, which the creditors then vote on. All of this is supervised by the court. And if all goes well, Teddy's will emerge from Chapter 11 leaner, meaner, and less insane. However,
most Chapter 11 cases fail.
Really?
Yes.
The numbers are hard to come by, but from what I gather, only a quarter to a half of Chapter 11 plans every year are approved by the courts and or the creditors. Gottlieb says a lot of companies file too late, long after their creditors have thrown up their hands. Usually, the failed cases lead to liquidation.
So then we skip ahead to Chapter 13.
Chapter 13 is my favorite chapter of bankruptcy. And
you have a favorite chapter of bankruptcy?
Absolutely. It's the most fun chapter of bankruptcy.
But like Chapter 7, Chapter 13 is for individuals. Or in this case, the landlady of our fictional building, Mrs. Jones. She's way behind on her mortgage, and the lender is threatening to foreclose. She's got credit card and tax debt, too, so she goes to see Lawyer Rick, who asks her,
are you earning anything?
Mrs. Jones replies,
yeah, I'm getting money now from Saul. He's finally got himself working.
And Teddy's finally paying her, too. Plus, she's got a little Social Security money coming in. So Lawyer Rick says,
I'm going to recommend a Chapter 13 case for you. Why? Well, Chapter 13, unlike Chapter 7, is an income-based form of bankruptcy.
As opposed to asset-based.
Precisely.
It's more like a payment plan. And how much you pay depends on how much you earn. The fun part is telling the creditors that they're only getting a fraction of what's owed them. So the IRS gets its money in installments, but without interest and penalties.
The credit card companies, they keep banging on the door. We want to be paid in full. No, no, no. You're paying them 10 cents on the dollar on the principal balance. Bye-bye.
Unfortunately, most Chapter 13 cases fail too. People just don't keep up with their payments, in which case the creditors can swoop in. But if they do keep up, Gottlieb says, Chapter 13 can have a happy ending, as can the other chapters in our story.
Does that mean everyone should file a Chapter 7 case or a bankruptcy case? Absolutely not. That's foolish. Bankruptcy is like financial streaking. You don't really want to do this sort of thing every day of the week.
And that, boys and girls, is as good a moral as any. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money. The end.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing, ConstantContact.com. Marketplace Money is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at SaveAndInvest.org.
Okay, we're back with more Getting Personal. It's the part of the show where we hear from you. And Chris, we have Mike on the phone from Park City, Montana. Mike, what's your question for Chris?
Well, my son inherited quite a bit of money last year, trust fund for college. And as we know, the market's gone belly up. So I'm kind of wondering whether I should take the money market out and put it in some short-term CDs. He is a senior. He's going to go to school next year, and this is what the money was for.
So you had the money in a money market mutual fund, it sounds like?
Yeah, it's from an estate that my aunt had.
You know, the money market mutual fund, this is something that was supposed to be a guaranteed investment. You put a dollar in, you're going to get at least a dollar out.
Right, plus some interest.
But a few months ago, one of the money market mutual funds did what they call break the buck, and people lost money on it. So I think Mike is asking here whether he should be pulling out of his money market mutual fund and putting that money somewhere else.
A couple of things. I mean, one, in terms of money market mutual funds, the Treasury did come up with its stabilization program to backstop the industry. Basically, I'm a supporter of it. I think it's, for most people, it's reasonably safe so long as you're in the very safe side of the money market mutual fund industry, which is primarily Treasury bills. But the other thing is, because there's a short-term obligation coming up, he's going to be going to school, you know you're going to be paying those tuition bills, you know, I would lock it into a certificate of deposit, federal deposit insured institution, federally insured credit union, because why take any risk whatsoever with this money? So, you know, if it were me, I would put it into checking account, savings account, some certificates of deposit, dividing the money up a little bit depending on where you're going to be writing those checks, which you'll be writing quite a few checks and fairly large checks over the next couple of years, just to remove any risk from this money whatsoever.
Mike, does that help you out?
Yeah, it does a lot. Appreciate it.
Okay, terrific. Well, if you're weighing your options on any financial front, do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, next we'll take an email question, and it's from Shelley in Three Forks, Montana. She works in human resources, and she finds herself in the position of wanting to do what you and I do, which is give a little financial advice to employees at her company.
Okay.
She's wondering if, given these trying economic times, she should be encouraging the people who are not currently participating in the 401k program to start. She points out, of course, that they would be buying low by doing this. Sounds like a pretty good argument to me.
First of all, in terms of getting people who are not participating in that 401k, that 403b, and this is a tough time to get into the market, absolutely encourage them. Start saving for the long term, particularly because you have that match and you can just go out there and preach the benefits of the match. It's money that you don't want to leave on the table. And yes, this is a tough time, but you want to start saving for the long haul. So I agree with her there. Now, buying low.
That assumes that we're going to buy stocks.
Exactly. Now, I'm very comfortable buying stocks. I'm very comfortable thinking that there's some real value in the stock market. Well, eventually, I hope that I'll be right. But a lot of people are hesitating because they're nervous. So what? Don't put your money in the stock market. Put it into government bonds. Put it into government bills. Put it into the most conservative option offered by your 401k. What really matters is not the market timing. It's not buying low. It's participating in the plan. What you want to tell them is get in that plan. Get that match. Save for the long haul.
And frankly, as someone in HR, you probably don't want to be persuading people either way where they should be investing. But you can certainly encourage people to start setting money aside no matter where they're putting it.
And you're absolutely right, Tess. The rules of the game are set up in such a way that HR has an incentive to get more and more people to participate in the plan. What they don't have incentive to do is to tell people actually where to put that money.
And one more email question. This one is on real estate investing. Sarah in Brooklyn, New York, is in her 20s, and she's wondering about buying a plot of land. She's not talking about a home or a condo, but just the land on which a home would sit. So she's wondering two things. One, is it a good time to buy land? And two, is land generally an investment that will appreciate, even if a home wouldn't?
Now, I used to live in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. And when you live in Brooklyn or Manhattan, there's the lure of owning your own property somewhere outside the city, vacation home, second home. So there are a couple of risks. Yes, land can appreciate. Right now, farmland is still strong. However, a lot of developers that have gotten themselves into financial trouble, who were dividing properties up, they've got a little bit of excess supply, not a whole lot of demand for their properties. So you can buy stuff probably at a reasonable price. But you get back to some real fundamental basics here, Tess. One, do you really want to live there? I mean, build a second home, a vacation home. I assume eventually that's what you're going to want to do. Or is it a speculation because you believe other people are going to want to build vacation homes there? Two, you got to really get to know the area. You need to understand the dynamic, understand where the growth's going to be. And that leads to my third thing. What will the local government do? If you go buy the land, with the local government, are they going to change the rules? Are they pro-development? Are they going to let you do what you want to do on the land? Are they going to put a lot of easements on there? How is this going to work with the local government? So it's still, in the end, it's not necessarily a bad idea. It can be a good investment. It is more of a speculation. And you really have to understand the downside risk.
Okay, Sarah, thanks for writing in. And unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions this week. But Chris is answering your questions online every weekday now on his blog. That's at marketplace.org. You can also find the Getting Personal link there and write us a question. Or go the old-fashioned route. Pick up the phone and give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And you can go ahead and leave a message there. Thanks again, Chris, for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Earlier in the show, we profiled folks who are trying to buck the annual orgy of holiday gift giving. They're reducing their gift footprint by giving things like food, which won't end up gathering dust in the attic. Another idea? The gift of an experience, like, say, tickets to the Nutcracker. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we go on stage to meet a woman who emerges from a cabbage after being brought to life by Herr Drosselmeyer.
My name is Heather Myers, and I'm a soloist with Boston Ballet. People's perceptions of dancers' lifestyles are always very interesting. I find when I meet people, either A, they're surprised that you can actually make a living as a ballet dancer, or it's the opposite end of the spectrum and they assume it's this glamorous lifestyle where you make tons of money and it's this amazing thing. It's actually halfway in between the two, I would say. I was a very energetic and active little girl, and I think my mother put me into dance lessons just to try and work some of that energy out. I realized that dance was a really important thing for me and also a real possibility in my life when I decided to go away to a professional ballet school, which was in Toronto, Canada, the National Ballet School. The way that I got my first job actually was by applying for a type of apprenticeship, and over time, I suppose my director appreciated me and eventually hired me full on into the company there. Professional companies work at a much quicker rate, and I do remember feeling very, very nervous and also having an almost obsessive compulsive need to review the choreography over and over and over again. It is very intense training. Usually I'm looking at 5 to 6 hours of rehearsals. Some of that time is spent learning choreography, other time is spent just doing repetition and just simply practicing the movements. Sometimes when I go to a party or a social event, people even go so far as to say, can you show us something? Can you do a dance right now? And what they don't understand is that there is a lot of preparation and warm-up involved. I'm not about to break into a variation from the Nutcracker in someone's living room. When I first joined Boston Ballet, I only made 600 something a week, I think, and now I make 1,327 a week. So there is decent money to be made as ballet dancers, and there should be. I think it's important for people to know that dance is something to be really respected. And I personally think that the arts, even in difficult financial times, are very important thing to have in our society because it enlightens us and keeps us in touch with the wonderful parts of ourselves.
That was professional ballerina Heather Myers. If you want to learn more about her, check out our website, marketplace.org. And while you're there, you can listen again to the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies. Anybody else going to have that in their head for days? The Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we profile some students who are shifting what they study as the job market tightens.
It doesn't even have to be a field that they're particularly passionate about. They just want to know, all right, when I graduate, I will be doing something.
Marketplace Money is produced with Jim Wallace, Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com.
American Public Media.